Hi, everybody. Why don't we go ahead and get started? I'm Eric Jensen. I'm a professor of astronomy and also environmental studies, and I'm also director of the Adelat Foundation, and so I'm really happy to see everybody here at this final fall semester version of our Second Tuesday Cafe. And it's my great pleasure to get to introduce our three distinguished panelists. So starting on the far end, I'm very pleased, as I know many of us are, to see Eric Behrens back here. So Eric recently became... He's going to stay. He told me he's back and he's not. Eric recently became
depending on your applause, he may or may not stay. So.
The chief information officer of Widener University. Prior to that, as many of you know, he worked at Swarthmore for 24 years, rising from network technician to associate CITO, leading academic technologies, media services, web services, and the recently merged language and media centers. He graduated from Swarthmore with his BA in theater studies and holds an MA from Gonzaga University in organizational leadership. He serves his professional organization, EDUCAUSE, as a faculty member for the new IT Managers Institute. Eric has completed the third year of his term as judge of elections, capacity in which he's speaking here today as an expert, for Nether Providence Township, 7th Ward, 1st Precinct. He served a previous four-year term as majority inspector of elections for the same district. He's also a three-term elected member of Delaware County Democratic Committee and a vice chair for the Nether Providence Democrats. Next is Susan Smythe. Susan is the ADA program manager and senior project manager in the facilities department here at Swarthmore. She spent many years in the college in a variety of capacities. And as the daughter of a Philadelphia committee person, she started early in politics with canvassing and mailings. And she served 8 years on borough council in Swarthmore, the last four as council president. She currently serves as Swarthmore's representative to the Central Delaware County Authority. And prior to becoming a judge of elections in Swarthmore's Western Precinct in 2013, she served many years as a poll worker and poll watcher, both in Swarthmore and elsewhere. Susan graduated from Wesleyan University with a degree in history. And then finally, last but not least, Mary Hasbrook has been judge of elections at Swarthmore's Eastern Precinct. So we have the Eastern and the Western Precinct represented here since November 2005. Her early involvement in the election system consisted of a few instances of knocking on doors and handing out leaflets, but she found the 2000 presidential election process so disheartening that she told the local Democratic committee chair that she'd be willing to help out in future elections. So that's always a dangerous thing to do unless you really mean it. So when the previous judge moved away, the committee called her bluff, and so there she is. So Mary graduated from Oberlin College with a BA in physics. I don't get any cheers for that. And a minor in computer science. She's worked at Swarthmore since 1984, spending 15 years in academic computing and then moving to the bricks and mortar side of the college as technology coordinator for facilities and capital projects. So warm welcome to our three expert panelists here. Now I'm going to turn it over to Ben Berger, professor of political science and director of the Lang Center, to kick us off. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Thank you so much all for being here. So cool. By the way, I'm pinch hitting for Carol Mackinoff, who's having foot surgery today. So if y'all want to send your get well cards to Carol, send good vibes her way right now. She'll be on crutches, but quickly back in action. If I know Carol at all, and I do. This is a great culmination of a theme that Adelat, along with the Lang Center and the Center for Innovation and Leadership, have done this whole year. This is the culmination of the semester, a theme that we've had of public discourse and democracy. We've had a bunch of lunches that Adelat has sponsored during this fall, and so it's great to have one not only on the topic of elections in an election year, but also I guess it's what makes Swarthmore such a fabulous place to be, to work at, to teach at, to learn at, is the fact that people who work here are so involved in politics. And I'm still counting you as one who works here, right? Because you both went here and you're still in your aura is still here, Eric. So what we're going to do is just let these great people talk about their experiences, about a couple of topics each. I might ask a few questions at some point in there, but really we'd love to have you all ask questions, either that arise, you can ask questions during the presentation if something is really immediate and it speaks to what's going on, or you can save it for afterwards in the end, all right? So our first speaker is gonna be Susan, right? You're gonna talk about the structure of what election judges of elections do.
So I first have to say that I am nursing a terrible cold. So A, I don't have a lot of voice, and B, mentally I'm somewhere else, but I'll try to stay with you. So So first I want to say we are just talking about Pennsylvania and we're really just talking about Delaware County. So don't get all excited about what else might be going on in the country or even, you know, elsewhere in Pennsylvania, because we don't necessarily have that expertise. So we're really just sharing with you our local knowledge. But I was going to talk about the structure of the election board, and something that always amazes me is that essentially all of this is done by volunteers. We do get paid the princely sum of between $90 and $100 for the 16-hour day, but you know, essentially it is people just like you who set up these polls every time and make sure that the elections are carried out fairly. And I think that's kind of a remarkable thing about this country, and hopefully we haven't lost that all in this last election. So the judge of elections is elected. They are on the ballot every 4 years, and as is the majority inspector, so-called. So the structure of the board is those two plus a minority inspector. And I always thought that was the person from the opposite party, but it actually isn't. It's just the person who got the lesser number of votes between the majority and minority inspector. And then there are possibly machine inspectors and a clerk. So essentially, we're there to make sure that people get signed in appropriately, that the machines are run appropriately. So for instance, in a primary, you probably get asked which party you are, and some people always get annoyed about that. Why are you asking me? Because the machines actually have to be set up that way. So we have to change the machine for each voter so that it counts in the appropriate party. And Pennsylvania has closed primaries, so only people in the two major parties can vote in a primary election. So essentially, the judge is responsible for collecting these people every time and making sure they show up on time. I'm very lucky. I have a very stalwart crew in the Western Precinct who have been there for a long time, and so I don't generally have an issue with getting people to work, but we certainly do hear across the county about places where there is nobody shows up. So the county has a group of people that is supposed to be sort of the emergency squad and will go open polling places, but it's kind of phenomenal to think that you could show up to vote and there's nobody there. So, when people are thinking about what they can do to be involved in the process, that's one of the things. It's somebody's got to be there on election day to get the polls open and running. We've also heard stories about people who don't turn in the count at the end of the night, or just take everything home and, oh, I'll bring it the next day. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. So we, at the end of the day, at 8 o'clock, have to do the count on the machines and do all the tallies and take everything back to media so it can get appropriately counted. So that's okay. Pretty much where I was leaving off.
And I'll just add, to kind of follow up on your point, Susan, that in most of the populous wards and precincts, probably an elected judge of elections, or at least as a volunteer, you know, regularly does emerge. But it's been my experience that in most jurisdictions, the positions which are also elected, a majority and minority inspector, are often go unballoted. So one of the things that you can do is, if you know that your polling place often does seem to be understaffed, or perhaps staffed by only people of the opposing party, you might think about whether you could twice a year manage to work as an inspector of elections, which has less responsibility in terms of setting up and closing down. So although it does have the 14, 15 hour day, it doesn't have quite the same. You free yourself up a little bit and just work on the day of checking.
Can I just have a quick follow-up on that? Are the people who work at each polling place required to be only voters from that
yes.
precinct?
Yes. You have to live in your precinct.
Yeah.
So that sort of segues into my, can you all hear me? I have a quiet little voice. So the topic that we chose for me to address was what types of things do judges of election have discretion over deciding in the course of the day? I'm actually in a precinct where we perennially don't have a minority inspector. Nobody ever runs the, you know. So even before election day, at my discretion, I have to round up somebody to be the minority inspector or a team of somebody. I can't find somebody for the whole day. And somebody be the clerk, because usually the minority inspector appoints the clerk. So that's one area that sort of falls on my discretion to find people who will be fair and balanced and do the job well. At the beginning of the shift on election day, the judge of election decides what roles the people on the board will play, because there are titles for these positions, but there are no specific rules about the minority. The minority inspector will do these tasks during the day, or the majority inspector will do these tasks. So it's up to the judge of elections to say, okay, here's how we'll work things today. Why don't you take these books? Why don't you take those books? You write the names down. We also have to decide, the election code says that you cannot have any political activity going on. So you know all those people outside who are handing out the leaflets and everything. That's a political activity. That can't happen inside the polling place. The election code says they have to be 10 feet away from the polling place, but they don't say you get to draw the line about where the polling place, where's the boundary of the polling place, and measure the 10 feet out from that. So some polling places are very small. I work at Borough Hall, and so there's an entrance hall for the library and the Borough Hall and the council room where we are. If it's a nice day, I say to them, 10 feet means outside the building. You know, have a nice day out there. If it's really cold and rainy and these people look so miserable, sometimes I'll say, okay, you can come. 10 feet will be from this door instead of this door. You can come in the lobby, but you can't come any closer than that far. So that's another example of discretion. We also have to, when we have watchers come in, people who want to come in and watch what you're doing. So that this is an official position, not on the board, but they apply to the county for certificates, watcher certificates. And there are watchers there can be watchers for each candidate, there can be watchers for each party. And the candidates themselves can have a watcher.
So parties and candidates appoint their own watchers. Mm-hmm.
But they have to be certified. They have to have a certified, you know, raised seal certificate for the day. And they have to present it to the judge of elections. And then, you know, you look at it and say, okay, that's fine. You sit over here where you're not going to be interfering. You're allowed to watch what we're doing from the opening of the polls to through the closing and the counting of the polls. And they may come and go. If it's a small place, like Susan's working in a gym, they've got oodles of space. We're in a very tight little room, and so I try to make a corner where they can sit and not get in the way. If too many of them came in, I would say, you know, let's balance this out here. It's getting too crowded. We need to give the voters room. I don't tend to get that many watchers in my certificate. Am I polling place? Yeah.
Clarification, do they have to be registered voters in that area?
No.
Too? Okay.
They have to be residents in the county. That was a big, you may remember right before election day this year, there was a move to try to have watchers be from anywhere, any county in the state, and that was, the courts did not allow that to go forward. And they're supposed to be, if they're particular to a candidate, that candidate has to appear on your ballot.
But they can go anywhere in the county that their candidate is on the
right
ballot.
What kind of information do the watchers relay to other people?
Typically, they're there to see, in the old days, this is interesting, they used to sit with a street list, so it would be a list of voters in your precinct, and because we have to call out the names, so they would cross people off. It was a way of doing get out the vote. You know, they would go back and say, well, you know, so-and-so hasn't voted, so we should call them.
He's still doing some of that.
Yeah, straight list.
In some,
yeah, not around him.
Not so much anymore.
Again,
you get that
a lot.
Okay.
And then the other thing is they'll you know, they can be there to make sure that the election is being conducted fairly. I don't want to step on Eric's toes, but, you know, that I have been in that situation where I've seen things that were not kosher, and so you could be the one to report that.
One of the things that watchers can do that no one else can besides the election board is be present at the count after the vote is closed. And there are official things that, by being there, they can do things about raising challenges about some of the, so that they do actually have the capacity, just by virtue of being there.
But especially in the area, given that Delaware County has historically had a Republican machine, right? So I'm from Chicago, Democratic machine. There was that in Philadelphia as well, too. There's an unusual Republican suburban machine here, which is lessening in power, but historically was quite strong. And in some of the areas where there are very strong party remnants, still, I've been a poll watcher where people have done just kind of checking off you're talking about and have gone out to call folks who had, and they knew each other, too. There's a lot of social capital. And they're so well organized, they'd go out to call people who hadn't yet shown up to vote.
In an earlier life, I did, you know, I was not an inside worker, being a nonpartisan worker on the day of the election. I did that kind of thing where, because the board does have to announce every voter, they come in, theoretically, your name should be announced out loud when you come to vote, which kind of creeps some people out, but
yeah.
Part of the purpose of that is so that people can verify the voter, and also that if there are any challenges, theoretically, that's the moment where somebody can say, whoa, wait a second.
Are you going to get to that? Like, when do those problems come up?
Yes, we are going to get
yes,
to that.
Yes, we are. But that's not not my topic, so let me go through the rest of my few examples here. Pennsylvania also, it's state law that, I think it's state law, not county law, that you can't do active electioneering inside the polling place. So that means you can't be talking up your candidate, saying to the person in line in front of you, don't forget to vote for Joe Blow. You're allowed to do what's called passive electioneering, which is wear a button for your candidate or a hat or something like that.
Voters can.
Voters.
We can.
Oh, yeah, the board can't do anything like that. And we do have people who say, okay, who should I vote for? But they get up to the desk and they ask us, who should I vote for? I say, oh, sorry, you don't know that now. We can't tell you that. So, but we do.
Undecided voters really do exist.
Oh, yeah. They get inside and then they start calling out, what does this question mean? They're inside the thing. You really should have looked that up before. I can't help you with that. And another thing is that, so the board has to verify people's signatures as they're signing in to vote. You go to vote, and the poll book has a stored digital copy of your signature there that we're supposed to compare signatures against. Or if you send in an absentee ballot, you're signing your name. And again, your digitized signature is in there that we're supposed to compare the signatures on. And that's something that does take a lot of discretion, because people sign up to vote, and over the years, their signatures have changed a lot. So we have had minority inspectors in the past who were quite sticklers about, you know, this does not, you know, this signature really doesn't match exactly. And so we kind of, I try to work with the board and go, well, you know, how much should we give them the benefit of the doubt here? So there was one envelope where the minority inspector was going, no, really, this is not, look at these signatures. And I'm going, yeah, I know, his signature's really changed over time. But he's going, no, there's no way that that's the same person. I said, well, that's my son's absentee ballot. And he just turned bright, raised, oh, I guess I can trust you on that. That was a good one. Eric was talking about the fact that we're supposed to announce the voter's name out loud, and we did have a case a couple years ago, and I apologize if I get any of the terminology wrong here, but it was an individual who was transitioning and had started the legal process to change her name, but had not gotten the county to recognize the new name. And so she came up to the desk, and she said, before you say anything, could you please not say that name? She was just very moved about, don't say my birth name out loud. That's not the name I'm going by now, and this is really important to me. And that was one of those calls. It was like, well, there weren't any watchers there. The idea behind that law is that the watchers can hear and they can strike the name off or whatever. And I just, you know, okay, that's fine. I know you. I seen you around, you've come in and voted under this name for a long time. So you've got the name change. And the next election, she came in and she said, it's in the book with my new name. And she voted very proudly under her new name and read it out loud for everybody. So that was another example. Do you guys have any more discretion topics that I missed?
I would say...
Students, people who aren't in the book. That's not really a discretion topic.
No, that's, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But I was just going to say, I think theoretically, I've looked back in some of the election code, theoretically the structure of these sort of two inspectors and then the judge, the inspectors are really supposed to be the people who qualify the electors. That's the theory. It's not necessarily how it's practiced. The judge decides who's going to do well. But because they're from different parties, the idea is they're supposed to act as a, theoretically, they're from different parties. They're supposed to act as kind of a check and balance on each other. And so if there's a disagreement between the two inspectors about whether this person is qualified to vote, the judge would be kind of the tiebreaker. And that's actually how I run it. I try not to get involved in the qualification unless they're really stuck. They just don't know what to do with the voter. Then I come over and sort of sometimes pull that person aside, kind of figure out what's going on, and then, so that we can keep other people
right.
moving through and voting. Because ultimately, you know, that is part of the discretion is trying to figure out how to keep everybody able to vote and not sort of tie people up needlessly with a lot of administrative excess. Should I go?
Go.
So my topic for today was to talk about the part that I think that a lot of people are wondering about and care about, which is sort of questions about how votes can be lost in the polling place. Now, I want to kind of stipulate that I'm here to talk about the part that I can see when people are at the polling place itself, and I can't talk about sort of the voting rolls and people's registrations and things like that, because that happens with an election board in our county over in Media. Sorry, not election board, the election bureau. But there are ways that you can, your vote could not be, might not be counted. There, I want to also say, they're usually pretty rare. I mean, these are not everyday occurrences. We may each have a story of the one time, that one election, this happened. But it is possible for voters to raise a challenge, for voters who are in polling place at the time, or for watchers to say that, person is not who they say they are, and then we may have to try to adjudicate that. Oftentimes it can be clarified without any kind of official process, but that does happen. There is a very explicit challenging process, though, for absentee ballots. So the way absentee ballots are counted is when you go into the polling place, somewhere in that area, there's supposed to be a list of every person who submitted an absentee ballot. It's actually a matter of public record if you submitted an absentee ballot. People can look at that list. At the end of the day, when we close the polls, we begin to do the count on the absentee ballots. We slice open the envelope. We verify all of the ballots, and if there are any questions, at that point, before we even open the ballots and start counting them, people can officially challenge. This, I know I have a story where this has happened at least in one election, and you've had this happen, right? It is sometimes in what's expected to be a close election, oftentimes it's a local or municipal election, the case where the party will send a representative, and they will begin to challenge absentee ballots. That doesn't mean the ballot is not going to be counted for sure. It does mean that it could be thrown in a hopper and only counted later on after it's been reviewed. It could go be brought before a judge and people could fight to have it counted. But it is kind of one of the more, I think, dubious aspects of our election code that somebody could come in and just simply, they have to give a reason, but the reason could just be, I don't think that that's the right signature, or I think that's, that person was actually in town. Like, technically, it's not voting by mail. You're only supposed to vote if you weren't in town. The person can claim, I think they're in town. We just write it. They have to pay $10 to issue a challenge. So if they want to take out 15 ballots, they have to give us $150. We put it in an envelope, send it to the county. It's the county's problem. We never know whether that ballot got counted or not. And I don't know that as a voter, it's possible to find out. Maybe that months later you can call and find out, but I'm not even positive that you can.
The ballot may or may not be counted. The money definitely is.
The money is going.
It goes somewhere.
The money is going. And it is theoretically there too, I think, to keep people from doing a lot of just counting everything.
Right.
It's supposed to create some. But we have both experienced cases where, and I've seen that, you know, I know stories of both parties engaging in this activity, so I really want to make that clear as well. We've already kind of hinted at sort of the either mistakes or maybe excessive enforcement of rules by the board. So every board is different. We are volunteers. Some people are more experienced, less experienced. Some people have more of an attitude about strict adherence to the guidelines. We, you know, we all know what the rules are. We are all pretty straight arrows in trying to follow those rules. But you know, there's a like one thing that happens to voter IDs. Well, in the state of Pennsylvania, they tried to pass a law. The law was struck down in the court. So there is no law that says you have to show voter ID when you go to the polls. There is a law that predates that, which says that you do have to show an ID of some form when you show up at the polls for the first time in that district. So if it's your first time voting in that district, you do have to present it. I have seen my own board make a mistake when I was at the table of telling people the wrong rules about those IDs. They don't have to be photo IDs. They don't have to be state issued, government issued. They could be of utility bill, right? Just something that verifies your name, your address, and that you're that person. So if you have an overzealous board or somebody just misinterpreting the rules, you could theoretically turn away a voter who's otherwise qualified to vote. So it is always a good thing for people to know the rules. I don't run into too many cases where there is a voter who really believes that they were registered and they don't show up somehow, somewhere. So even if they're not in my book, if I call the county in the middle of the election, I can usually find out the story about why that person is not in my book. It's usually because they're registered somewhere else, they're in the wrong place. But if somebody, you may hear about people being struck from voter rolls after they haven't voted for a long time. When they do that in Delaware County, the good news is at least that they're entered in the book as being an inactive voter, and they're not just taking them right out of the book. So we get affidavits that people have to sign. They just sign their name and say, check a box and say, I still reside at this address and I intend to vote. Right? They sign their name, that goes back in. And but there is theoretically a point at which when a person is inactive for so long, they could fall off the rules.
And you have to show ID or proof of residence at that point too?
No.
Does it reactivate?
No. No. Interestingly, you don't.
You don't.
And we had a lot. I had a lot of those this time. It's interesting.
And how did the county ask you to address it?
Just the affidavit.
Just the affidavit. Point.
Yeah.
Okay. They let them proceed to regular ballot. The other thing that can happen, and this, you know, you've heard about provisional ballots. I don't know if anybody here has ever had to vote with a provisional ballot, but this was introduced in the law, I think, after the 2000 election, where if for some reason you're told you cannot vote at a polling place and you're certain you wish to challenge that, I, as a judge, can offer you the provisional ballot, which allows you to fill out the ballot. It goes into a sealed envelope. You don't pay anything, but you do get a receipt, like a receipt that just says that you submitted this with a phone number, and you can call later on, like 2 weeks after the election or 10 days after the election, to find out whether your provisional ballot got counted. That it's at the discretion of people at the county, whether they choose to count it or not. Because it's kind of a black box to us, we don't really know what the likelihood is of that ballot being accepted.
I think they're supposed to, the person is supposed to be registered to vote at that place in order for the...
No, if they're registered to vote at that place, then we would just
let
them
vote.
Then
they'd be voting.
Yeah.
If they were registered in our books, then they'd be voting. So this is for people who are not in our books, but they say, but I've lived here for 15 years and I've always voted here. Or they say, you know, I moved here and I filled this out and I can't just go back to Georgia to vote today. And I swear I filled the thing out and I should vote.
Here's a real life example where I did use a provisional ballot. We had a voter come in the primary this spring. The person was sure they were registered for one of the political parties. But in our books, they were listed as being independent. No, I voted in that election, and I voted in that primary, and I truly believed her. She was passionate, but she was knowledgeable. She knew what she was talking about. I called up, as we're supposed to do, I called up the County Election Bureau. I said, I need a history on this voter to find out. They said, oh, yeah, no, they were registered in that party at that time. But then in 2010, they changed back to an independent. And I asked, do you remember resubmitting your form and voting as an independent? No. And I said, okay. And on a hunch, I said, look at your driver's license and figure out when you last went to pick up a driver's license. It is a known fact that prior to 2010, there was a period of time when people were using motor voter registration. They would go to fill up, get their new driver's license. They get the little computer screen kiosk, and it would ask you, do you want to register to vote? A lot of people did that even though they didn't need to. You don't need to re-register. Once you're registered, you're stay registered. But a lot of people just sort of did it, fearing that maybe they need to re-register. And at that time, there was a period where those registered, you got re-registered, and they just re-registered everybody automatically as an independent. So it did not disenfranchise them from the general elections, but it kept them out of the primaries. So the county would not back down because they had an official record, although in a conversation, one of them did acknowledge it's a known defect. So I had the person vote provisional, and we filled out the affidavit. The only other thing I want to say is that user error is actually a real risk, the biggest risk, probably. So the classic thing that we call the fleeing voter scenario is people fill out a ballot and they forget to press the green button. They're already out the door. Theoretically, we're not supposed to go and touch those machines. Nobody's supposed to touch the machine. We've been given the interpretation that now a person on our board can kind of, without looking,
two people together, the minority inspector and the judge, can both reach under.
Reach under and press that button if you think that's what happened. We have people, I'm certain, because of the number of undercounts we see, who think that they're pressing the right button on those machines and probably not, and so their votes are not being registered. There are people who incorrectly do write in ballots, they don't write in the little window on the paper tape. They actually write on the machine.
On the face of the machine.
And then we have to call the county to have them come out and clean it, because if you use the wrong cleaner, you can basically ruin the machine.
$40,000.
So user error of that type is in fact
small children.
Oh, small children. We warn the parents because it's right at toddler height. It's a big green button. What does this do? And if they've selected one voter, that's it. They're done. They're like, wait, I wasn't done.
I actually ask every single parent, and our board does too, to keep the children to the left.
Yes.
Buttons on the right.
So smart. And then the final thing I wanted to mention, and this isn't really, if you're determined to vote and you get in and you're registered to vote and you go and use the machine, all's good. The one issue I did want to mention about the space, though, is the question of voter intimidation and not being able to know if in all precincts what percentage of people don't, avoid the polls and turn back because of actual acts of voter intimidation. And the story I would just share there is, I'm now at a very friendly, bipartisan polling place. Everybody comes out election day. It's like, it's like the town picnic. The previous place where I was, the same house, but I used to be in a different district, has had a history of people lining up outside the doors, and they were all of one party, and they had people in uniforms, so law enforcement officers, and then a bunch of the committee people all in suits, and it formed this gigantic funnel that you had to walk through a thin line, very crowded out. And I know that a lot of people just said, I just hate to go for it. I hate it. Yeah. They didn't actually turn anybody away, but boy, was that intimidating. A big line of, 12 men sort of standing there staring at you when you came in. And technically they were within the law, because the law in Pennsylvania does not really protect voters from that kind of, just 10 feet away from the door.
Right.
I have to see evidence of them actually obstructing voters. Now, I would speak up. I would use, the bully pulpit to just say, come on, guys. You need to give voters more space. You need to let them enter here freely. But
that's one of the things a watcher can do and protest against.
And the reason why I think it was so intimidating is what you're referring to is because these are areas in which sort of heavily one party or the other, in this case it was usually Republicans in Delaware County, and they're local precincts, so people know each other. So those who, when I worked as a poll watcher, one place I was the Democratic poll watcher, and I was first, the others were sort of hostile to me, and they found out that I was a friendly guy. I was talking about their grandchildren with them, and they became friendly, and then they would point out, they'd say, oh dear, I think that one is a Democrat, because one out of every 10 people were Democrats. So when one was coming up the walk, they knew the person, they'd, why don't you give your literature to that person, they might take it. So they knew everyone, they knew who was whom, so therefore it's intimidating for people to walk through, because they're known to be the other party, and these are people of this party, and that I think is part of it. Right.